Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. We are back with another celebration of physical media, but in season 6, we're doing things a little differently. This year, I was gifted so many wonderful releases by the good people at Criterion that I can't just put all of our conversations together in one episode devoted to physical media. So you're getting a suite of episodes featuring some of my dearest friends and your favorite guests. I hope you enjoy them. Thank you so much for listening. First up, we have Krista Faust, who is the award-winning author of Money Shot and numerous other crime and horror novels. She received the Scribe Award for her novelization of Snakes on a Plane. Her graphic novel Peepland, written with Gary Phillips, was inspired in part by her early days as a Times Square peep show girl. Director Quentin Tarantino once said, "Krista Faust is a Veronica in a world of Bettys." And her latest novel, the third and final installment in her Angel Dare trilogy, is called The Get Off. Well, with me right now is my friend Krista Faust, hot off our adventures in Phoenix. So really excited to have her back to discuss Winchester 73, which is one of her favorites. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. It's funny the way that people will kind of hive off the genres that they are interested in based on preconceived notions. And one, if I achieve nothing else with this conversation, let's hope that we get a few people who are like, ew, Westerns. You know, but like, just hold on a second, because what do we always say? It's not the hat, it's what's going on underneath.
I love that so much. I know, I was someone, like, my parents enjoyed Westerns, and I watched some growing up, but I wasn't really into it. It wasn't until I left Minneapolis to move to Arizona, and it was actually my grandma's sister had this great movie collection. She loved John Wayne movies, old Westerns, and loaned me a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I watched Shane, I watched a bunch in a row, and I'm like, this is the greatest thing ever. And it just kind of clicked. So, yeah, I think the genre, it's rich. Everything, every Western is different. It's not a one size fits all kind of thing. And Anthony Mann Westerns are so good because, you know, he was a hell of a great noir director as well. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this was so long ago that, like, don't hold me in a court of law, but I'm pretty sure that the first noir film that I ever watched was T-Men.
Okay.
You know, and that kind of set the tone in a lot of ways, I think. And, yeah. And yeah, it's funny because I kind of feel a parallel, like, older person appreciation for Westerns in the same way that getting older has made me more appreciative of, like, outlaw country.
Yeah.
Which, growing up in New York City, I'm like, country music, are you kidding me? Like, what does that have to do with my life, right? Nothing. However, I would argue, and this is true, not so much for, like, your standard, you know, Hollywood, Gene Autry, singing cowboy type of stuff, but like for this kind of stuff, the darker stuff.
Yeah.
There is something that happens to you when you cross that Rubicon of middle age, mm-hmm. right? And when my Pop Faust, who's a musician, and I were living back home in New York City and I'm taking care of him, his favorite radio station was called The Big Broadcast. And it was a radio show that was 20s and 30s pop and big band music. And the tagline used to be radio for the old and the old at heart.
I love that.
And I would argue that this particular style of Western, along with a lot of the, you know, kind of storytelling style, outlaw country music, you know, people like Billy Joe Shaver, Charles Van Zandt, there is something middle, just quintessentially middle-aged in that feeling of regret and complex emotion that doesn't fit easily into black hats and white hats.
No.
And that's the key, I think, to Winchester, is that it really does explore that gray, the gray hat Western, like I like to call it.
Yeah, and it was kind of, you know, it was made in that era of the gray hat Western, for sure. You know, I think we started out with the white hat, and then, you know, as John Wayne movies got, as he got older and the eras changed and we had more wars, you know, it got darker. But it kind of was like that for all of these. One thing I love about Anthony Mann is, you know, all these films are really fast moving. They're terse, they get in, they get out. But I think it's cool. It's like why I love Hitchcock working with Jimmy Stewart is when we see Jimmy Stewart in these modes, it's not the guy that we remember from like It's a Wonderful Life or these movies. It's, you know, it's him, like you said, full of regret, kind of at a crossroads in his life. Where is he going? Or he might think the best years are behind him and doesn't know what's ahead. And I find that really interesting. So it is great. Midlife crisis, midlife, you know,
Midlife noir.
Yes.
Midlife noir.
Yeah. Existential Westerns. Yes. I love it.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I just rewatched it again last night just to kind of refresh,
yeah,
you know, since it had been a while. And one of the moments that really struck me along that spectrum of emotion was the moment where Jimmy Stewart just kind of manhandles Dan Duryea.
Oh my
And
gosh, on the
it's just a
bar.
close up of his face. Yes.
Yes.
And you see this like
rage.
This rage, you know, that
yeah.
you're not used to seeing from
No.
an actor like that.
No.
You know, and to kind of like have that like short circuiting of the civilized and that sort of unleashing of this animalistic rage, I thought that was a moment that really stood out to me. And in a weird way, I can't draw a direct line, but I do feel that there is a connection between having watched Winchester and the Angel Dare novels, because Winchester was one of the first movies that really got me thinking about the consequences of vengeance.
Yeah, no, I love that idea. Exactly. I think, and how it changes you because we've seen him through this movie. One thing I also love is how it doles out information in a really careful way. We know that he is looking for this man, Dutch. They're both at the same event, shooting event, and they're going to win a Winchester 73, the gun that won the West, essentially. And he's there to settle a score. It's personal. We know, it'll probably get revealed, but the way it gets revealed and as it continues on and it becomes a thing where this gun, it's almost a doomed weapon, kind of a nice little overview of the West and regret. Goes from person to person and more tragedy ensues. And the way we finally find out that, spoiler alert, Dutch is his brother, is amazing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in a way, you could almost say that opening scene with the little boys admiring the gun is about admiring violence and the kind of sexy lone wolf cowboy, you know, fisticuffs version of balletic violence from a distance. And then the people who actually pick up the gun, who actually perpetrate the violence, it changes them. It doesn't make them fabulous. Like, because so many people throughout the movie say, if only I had this gun, I would be amazing. But then the people who actually do have it, it ruins them. And I think that's a really interesting metaphor for the consequences of violence.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you. And I find all of the, peripheral characters, the people who only have a scene or two, just completely fascinating as well. And I think what's great about this one, and I love all the Anthony Mann westerns, and he made so many with Jimmy Stewart. Some of my favorites, like The Naked
Oh, yeah.
Spur, of course. But one thing that I really dig about this is Shelley Winter's character. Shelley Winter's in noir
Shelley
and
Winters.
westerns. My goodness, because she was kind of.
Incidentally, a sex worker, can we just point out?
Yes. And a complicated woman at the beginning. She's being like run out of town. And then her arc as it continues on and how men treat her and how she's going for dignity. Shelley Winters, I always found to be really fascinating on screen and off screen because, we see her in like A Place in the Sun and these kind of films where she's a Lolita, she's playing a certain part. But if you look at the films she made and the sides of womanhood and sexuality, I find her really fascinating. Yeah.
Really, really fascinating. And then I have an existential question to which I don't have an answer, but I'm going to bounce it to you because I can't stop thinking about this. Like, what is the deal with the suicide bullet? Why is the suicide bullet like a romantic token? Okay, so she says to him when he gives her the gun, she says, "I know what that last bullet is for."
Yeah.
And what she's referring to is so that I will not be captured, I'll use that last bullet to shoot myself.
Yes.
That's the implication of that line, which is not sexy or romantic.
No.
That's kind of intense. But then she asks for him to give her that bullet as a souvenir. That she's,
No.
Is it because she survived?
That's what
It's
I
so
was
odd
trying
to
to
me.
think. Yes, it is odd. Like part of me, I actually watched this film. I'd seen it before, like a long time ago. And then Criterion sent me the 4K, which is gorgeous. And I watched that when I got it. And then I just rewatched it. I liked it better on the second rewatch. This one that I just finished up this morning, started it last night again. And because that was a little fuzzy to me too. And I think part of it is maybe she survived. Maybe also in a weird way, it was okay. She had this guy who just like bailed on her and then comes back and he was, a chicken that Stuart wanted to give her, like, you're in charge of your own fate a little bit. And like,
maybe.
I don't know. It's odd. Yeah.
That is an odd little moment, but in a way, maybe it has to do with her. Like you said, like her autonomy, her being able to make choices, because so many times throughout the story, we see this woman being, having her choices taken away.
Yes.
You know, she's run out of town. She's captured by Dendorier. She's abandoned by her cowardly husband. These are choices that are taken away.
Yeah.
And the fact that a stranger gave her, believed that she had the ability to make a really, really difficult decision like that on her own. Maybe that's what that's about.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just thought it was, it just stuck with me. And I couldn't stop thinking about that last night.
Yeah, it's weird. It is. It's like you're in charge of your own fate and I'm giving you the choice. The choice is yours. I'm not going to make it for you. I don't know. And she also survived. So there's a weird thing going on. But I do find her character to be particularly interesting. Also, the head of the cavalry when they are in there and the whole repartee and the camaraderie and the relationship between him and Stuart. Great.
Okay, well, and let's just also talk about how much we love Jay Flippin just generally. I
Yeah,
mean, he's in The Killing,
yeah.
Right? I loved him in The Killing. I love his face, his eyes, his expressiveness. He's just one of those character actors.
Yeah.
Like anytime you see him, you're like, yes, this is going to be awesome.
Or Dan DeRay, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, Dan DeRay.
The voice, the face, yeah.
Yes. I remember Eddie Muller once saying to me that that there are certain actors that are associated with noir, you know, Robert Ryan, Humphrey Bogart, big names. But the truth is, if you want to know whether or not you're in a noir film, look for Dan DeRay. If you see Dan DeRay, it's noir. And then here we are in a Western, but what is it? It's noir.
Noir.
You know,
Yeah.
he's doing his too late for tears shtick.
Oh my
You
God, I
know, that
love
kind of
Late for Tears.
charming
Yes.
scumbag. Yes.
Yeah, that's a
Yeah.
great movie. If you're listening and you don't know that one, I think it's available like everywhere, 'cause I think yeah, it's in the public domain. So yeah, but it's great. Yes. So do you remember, was this like an early Western favorite for you or one you came to later?
It's, I think I came to it because of being interested in Anthony Mann. And it
Yeah.
was sort of like, you know, I don't really like this genre, but I like this director. So
Yeah.
I guess I'll give this a chance.
Yes.
And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. There's something else going on here. And that existential darkness
Yeah.
that you see underneath the, you know, rugged cowboy lifestyle, everything is kind of ugly and broken, and all of the characters have this tremendous baggage. And, you know, I mean, this is a movie about, you know, like killing your family members.
Yeah.
It's really intense. But at the time, I couldn't say that it was a favorite Western because I didn't like Westerns, or I just didn't see any. I wasn't interested. So it
Yeah.
was kind of more, I won't say it was my favorite Western. I'd say it was a gateway Western. It was what got me
Okay.
willing to try
Yeah.
something. It's like when you're a kid and you're like, ew, you know, I'm not going to eat, I don't know, oysters.
Yeah.
But then you get older and you try it. And then the next thing you know, you're willing to try a lot more exotic types of food.
Yeah. No, that's a good way of putting it. Yes. And also I think you made an excellent point with the darkness and the ugliness and of these movies that he is doing something different. I think my favorite Western that it isn't with Stewart, but that man made is Man of the West. In the Pandemic Movie Club, I made
Oh, yeah.
everybody watch Man of the West. And so I think at first, it starts out and it's kind of like, upbeat and Gary Cooper smiling and stuff, and then it just gets darker and darker and darker, and you don't know where it's going. And I love that. And so that's kind of like the beginning of this. He rides into town. We know there's some kind of tension, but by the end of it, exactly like you say, like he is going to kill a family member on behalf of a family member or revenge. Yeah, it's
Exactly. But of
wild,
course, I
very
think we're both,
biblical. Yeah.
oh
Yeah.
yeah, no question. But you know, it's interesting to me that he does really focus on male relationships.
Yes.
That, like, yes, the Shelley Winters character is there, and
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
she's
yeah.
relevant in the story, but that's not the real meat of the
No.
story. The real meat of the story, him and his best friend, him and his brother, him and his father, and all of this. And of course, because we're middle-aged now and the
Yeah.
oatmeal, I can't remember what is the Barbara Stanwyck, the one that he did with Barbara Stanwyck, the Western.
But the Furies? The Furies. Oh,
The
that's a
Furies.
great one.
So
Yeah.
here's a funny observation about the Furies, which is that, you know, as I was kind of like, you know, picking through some, you know, thoughts last night and writing up little notes and things, and I was rereading about the Furies, which I also like because
Yeah.
I'm a huge Barbara Stanwyck
Oh
mark.
my gosh, I know. Love her.
I'll watch her do anything. But I was reading somebody had done a little write-up about it where they were very sneery and they were like, you know, well, this isn't really a Western. It's just melodrama. And it's funny because we know what that word melodrama really
Oh
means.
yeah.
It means girly stuff. It means it
Yes.
isn't manly men having manly friendships with other manly men.
Yes.
It's like, no, it's lady business. It's, you know,
Lady business, yeah.
it's lady business, but it's also Anthony Mann. You know,
Yeah.
so he brings his very kind of traditionally masculine sensibility to what is ostensibly a very feminine family, again, family oriented. It's kind of a story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's twisted, it's dark, it's perverse. If you guys have not seen The Furies, watch that one too. It was funny. A few years ago, Slate hired me to do or to co-create an episode on Westerns and sexuality and men and women and stuff. And my the co-host that I was working with was not a fan of Westerns, and I don't think she was as into it. It was to tie in with Power of the Dog, and I kept citing things like The Furies and this and going all nerdy. So I love this, Krista. This is great. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So Any other observations? You said you were writing some notes, doing some reading that you want to make on this one?
Well, I mean, first of all, shout out to gratuitous Tony Curtis for no reason. Like,
Exactly.
I just love him. Like, you know,
He's
because
popping
whenever I
up.
just like, hey, how you doing? You know, I kind of see him as
Yeah,
like
Rock
that sort
Hudson's
of
in there for a second. Yeah.
shirtless Rock Hudson
Yes.
gratuitously as an Indian. So there's that. And I mean, we do have to say that, like, obviously there's a lot of kind of attitudes towards indigenous people in this
Yeah,
movie that
that
are
little
of the
dated there.
time.
Come on. Yes,
But
but.
Devil's Doorway, Devil's Doorway, which is another, am I getting that name right? Devil's Doorway. Anyway, that is another Anthony Mann Western that kind of challenges some of those preconceived notions about, you
True.
know, the culture and First Nations people, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you kind of, if you were going to watch movies like this, you sort of have to, it's kind of like the thread of misogyny in film noir.
Oh,
It's
absolutely.
like,
Yeah.
you know it's there. So you
Yeah.
can't, you know, you have to sort of say, all right, I'm going to accept that there are going to be things in here like shirtless, gratuitous Rock Hudson for no reason as a Native American that are going to be just ridiculous.
Yes.
But if I accept those things as just a part of that oeuvre,
Yes.
you can still pick out really meaningful, interesting,
Oh, yeah.
thought-provoking stuff from the miasma of these old-fashioned ideas.
I know. I think that's kind of hurting media literacy even today,
Yeah.
is people get so hung up on like one little thing in a film that they don't like, or something. Now, if it's woven throughout an entire film, as you and I have talked off air about some movies that we won't go into, but you know, exactly, a certain auteur. But
Oh
anyway,
yeah.
that was hilarious.
But
But
I also think that if you're alive today and you're still doing that shit, you give
yeah,
no
that
quarter.
is a different story. Yep.
That's a different story. But I mean, you know, there were a lot of attitudes, you
Yeah.
know, that are not
Yes.
really considered appropriate today. But I think that if you want to teach people to be
Yes.
more open-minded and to learn more
Watch
about
things.
our history, it's
Yes.
like, you know, if you like have a knee-jerk immediate reaction where I don't want to see anything racist,
Yeah,
well,
or
maybe you should take time to interrogate that thing.
why and what? Yes.
Why and what? And then to also reflect that back on your own self and your
Yeah.
own complicity and the ways in which you are a part of that history, you know, and by denying history, you're not fixing things. You're just
Not
kind of
helping.
stitching up an infected wound. It's just going to make the infection worse. You have to talk about it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
That's my
that's
two
why the
cents.
humanities are so important, and that's why
Yes.
cinema and, you know, literature, these are part of the humanities, art, exactly, for all of these reasons. And I
Yeah.
think,
Ask questions. Ask
yeah.
questions and look back at the way that the questions make you feel.
And
That's the most
why?
important part.
Yeah, that's what's
And why?
fascinating. Yeah. Write about it, do things. Exactly. A movie isn't just you know, the summary. Why did this happen, and what did it make you feel? Exactly. These are all great questions, Krista. I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's so exciting to me anytime I get to talk, well, to you, of course, but to women about Westerns and crime movies in general, because it's awesome. Yeah, so thank you very much. All right. Well, I am so happy to be back with two of my friends, the intrepid co-hosts from the B-side at the film stage. That is Connor O'Donnell and Dan Mecca. How are you guys?
How are you? Good to be here. Good to be back.
I took a pretty rough truck ride
Hey
here, if you could believe it. It was really
now.
crazy. Somebody was like, "Hey, can you go into the jungle and or desert, depending on your preference, and pick up some nitroglycerin?" But it's here now, so we're all good.
You
There were
made it.
there were three other guys with me, but they did not make it.
They didn't make it. Did you go over 6 miles an hour or?
No, kept it pretty
Oh.
cash, kept it pretty slow. Yeah, but
Yeah.
But such a funny.
I'm here.
I always forget the minutia of that first, the Clouseau movie is the whole like, you gotta speed up, bud. And then it's like the whole him not speeding.
Oh my God, I know.
Oh, it's very good. It's a very good movie.
And then like as it continues on and you see a guy like smoking a cigarette right next to the truck, like casually, and you're like, what the hell are you doing? Yeah.
Yeah. It's so insane. And I, Jen, have you seen The Great Waldo Pepper?
I have, but it's been, oh my gosh, like 20, 25 years. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. The only reason over the weekend, I had seen a rep screening of it. And we covered it on the B side with our mutual friend, Blake Howard. But there is a moment in that movie where there's a crash and gasoline is leaking. And one of the, so many of the onlookers are just like hanging out with cigarettes. And so I had that fresh in my brain. So like anytime someone had a cigarette in Wages of Fear, I was like, what are you doing? Put that out.
Crazy. Yeah. Yes.
That's so funny.
But yeah, I hadn't watched Wages of Fear. I was excited to rewatch it because I don't think I'd actually watched it since college.
Okay.
I tend to kind of, in my mind, Sorcerer edges it out a little bit for me.
Mm-hmm.
I used to kind of think like, oh, Sorcerer's like way better. And then I like rewatched it and I was like, well, that's dumb. They're both like incredible movies, but I think I kind of just like, I like Sorcerer's energy a little bit more. It's like the, I feel like the deep jungle of it all. And I think the, I don't know. There's just like a real deep scariness and kind of, unease to Sorcerer that I think Wages of Fear, if you can believe it, almost feels lighter, you know, like it's like,
yeah.
I think a lot of it is Yves Montand is like, it's almost because of him.
Yeah, he has a way different energy.
He's like a playboy, and he still has kind of that existential death wish thing. And obviously Clouseau, it's so interesting. I don't know, Jen, have you talked about him at all on the show? Probably not, right? Like Clouseau as like a filmmaker?
I think I did Diabolique,
maybe.
Yeah, forever ago we did Diabolique with Jed when we were doing remakes. Yeah.
Oh, right. Cause of the 90s remake.
Yeah.
It's which JJ Abrams is in. I always remember that.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Abrams is like one of the docu crew.
Yeah. Right.
In the remake, which is so funny.
He's the truck in Sorcerer too.
He's the truck in the 2024 remake. but he's a fascinating guy because he was a writer for so many years and like, he made these two masterpieces in a row and he made this like very beloved, documentary about Picasso, like the next year. And otherwise, you know, made a lot of work, but I don't know. I'm no expert, but it really is. It's a funny thing. It's like to make his, you know what I mean? Within 3 years, he made the three things
that he's like going to,
that he's the most famous for, right? And the success of Wages of Fear directly enabled him to make Diabolique, right? And then the Picasso doc obviously was a separate thing. And it's just, I hadn't really realized that. And he was kind of a sickly young man. He was in sanitariums. That's where he read. That's where he kind of learned to write. It's just like,
gotcha.
Some of the stuff I didn't even know. It was like kind of fascinating.
I mean, between him and Hurricane Billy Freakin, I don't know if you can successfully make a version of this story if you don't have a couple screws loose. You know what I mean? Like, forgive
Pretty
the
much.
Parlance, but I think you gotta be dealing with some stuff in order to like fully capture like the essence of this story.
Yeah.
Which like, I don't know how much we need to go into synopsis or anything, but like I love movies where something is like, on paper, potentially so simple, right? Like take the nitroglycerin specifically out of it, but just the notion of like, you got to go here, you got to get this thing, you got to bring it back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then like, and then in execution, it is so much harder and so much just more devious than you might think. And then imagine, right, that the thing you are told to go get is nitroglycerin, which is like, I think just such a beautiful, it's such a beautiful vehicle to attract only the most desperate people, right? Like the, like, yeah. It's just so fine tuned and accurately, or, and sort of precisely honed in to just be this thing that like only people who are in like the, maybe the absolute worst place in life they've ever been are like, are going to be capable of doing this.
Well, yeah. And I was saying right before we started recording, Jen, how I watched like the first half of the, they remade The Wages of Fear again, I guess, in 2024. I think it was a Netflix movie. It was a French movie, I believe. But it was kind of like, directed by, Julien Leclerc. Okay. And it's kind of with, I don't know that you would know a lot of the actors immediately, but the biggest kind of problem with it is there isn't the same desperation. They kind of set up stakes to essentially establish why these people would do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like action movie desperation, right? It's like, oh, my brother's in prison. If he does this, if I do this, he'll get out, right? Like this person's an expert in this. They're coming. And it's like half of the reason the first two versions of the story work is because they're not experts, right? It's like they're in a place, you know, there's a whole scene in The Wages of Fear that we're talking about, the original, where the guy who hires the drivers is literally like, we cannot go through the union because these guys will probably die. Yep. It's just like, I just think if you diminish that part of the story, it makes the story itself. Cause even think about like, even extrapolate off of that, you know, Mad Max Fury Road, you know, it's, sure, you're talking right. about, yeah. it's the same, you know, it's far different, but it's the same desperation, right? The idea of like, mm-hmm. the only way out is through, right? And so it's like, you only in that situation would it make sense. And so if you take that away and you kind of make it high concept, and which is kind of what that remake does, it just doesn't, you're just kind of like, okay, it's still a cool idea.
Well, that's the thing. Like, but, I mean, it, yeah, there's like a, there is such a beautiful simplicity to the narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
That, it makes, you know, I couldn't necessarily find specific, and I'm sure there is just in various reviews, but I like specific kind of sentiment or from around when Sorcerer came out of like, why would you remake it? It's the same kind of thing. I think about it. I've been thinking about Sorcerer a lot and seeing reactions to Spike Lee's Highest to Lowest, which is coming out this year, right?
Yeah.
It's got that thing of like, why would you do this? What would be the point, right? Which I always feel like can be really reductive because again, like there's something to the cleanliness of these narratives that I actually think makes them ripe for remakes, right? Like they're perfect things to be kind of picked up and dusted off and reworked in potentially different ways. And I feel like something like Sorcerer obviously is smart enough to like not go too far in any direction. It just kind of changes the atmosphere of the thing and then see how that kind of pivots the narrative, but
and adds the kick-ass soundtrack and that great prologue at the beginning, basically with all the different, yeah.
You get like a little bit more. I suppose you could make the argument it Sorcerer and Wait and the original Wages, you know, have this interesting case study in like, you know, leaving certain things to the imagination, right? Because like the prologue is one of the big differences where mm-hmm. you actually see where these men come from, right? Specifically.
Yep.
So you actually see the sort of desperate stakes that put them there. But to Dan's point, they're not like,
mm-mm.
you know, they're just, they could be anything. They almost
exactly.
in and of themselves feel totally superfluous, right? Like,
yeah.
Ending is, I mean, very different.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
Yes, right. But, the
overall, yeah.
Overall, like the you know, you have the I suppose the bridge set piece in Sorcerer, which mm-hmm. is similar to a set piece in Wages, but not kind of exactly the same thing. But the beats of the story overall are basically the same. And I think you know, one thing I forgot about Wages is you don't necessarily get the backstories of the men, but I feel like it does spend more time before they with them before everything kind of kicks off. It's a long, I believe it's like.
They're not, they don't get the inciting incident doesn't happen until the 39th minute.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like you get a pretty long kind of preamble of like the Latin American.
Yeah, they're not in the trucks till
like an
minute
hour
45.
In.
Yeah. Right. Maybe 50 minutes. Yeah. Into the,
in wages. Yeah.
In wages. Yeah.
Which I think is just, you know, I love stuff like that too, right? Where it's like you're really given some time to like, hang out with a group of folks so that when things start moving, you don't, you know, you don't have to look back. Right. And you kind of, you're given everything that you need. Especially when you kind of decide to give the movie a kind of night and day mentality in terms of the behavior of some of its characters, right? Like one of the most beautiful things I think about Wages, that I totally forgot is the Joe character and how, this isn't really present in Sorcerer, but that like that character is kind of the cock of the walk when they're in the town, right? And he's he's like this tough guy, right? He has a standoff ultimately with one of the guys who will go on to become another one of the four. But almost immediately he reveals himself to be kind of a loser and a coward, right? Like when push comes to shove. And I think that kind of stuff like that in movies I also love, especially when you're given so much time up front to really think you know everything that you need to know about a character.
Yeah. Now I'm looking, Dan sent me down the whole remake rabbit hole and I'm looking at Wages of Fear and I did not see Violent Road, aka Hell's Highway. I didn't see that version. And guys, I'm going to probably have to go watch this immediately after, but I guess there was an episode in season one, episode 8 of MacGyver called Hellfire that Wages of Fear.
Oh,
and
I'd
now
watch
I'm
that.
Like, I need to watch the hell
what
out of that.
What a good, I feel like there are
MacGyver, of course it was a MacGyver episode.
Yeah.
I love that.
There are other TV shows. Yeah. I feel like there are other TV shows that do that, but it really is. Like if I was writing for a TV show in like the 80s or whatever, and I was tasked with writing an episode, I too would probably find just a great movie and be like, well, I'm going to do the whole movie in like 22 minutes or whatever.
You know what I forgot since we're all kind of looking up a little bit? I forgot that the working title for Sorcerer was Ballbreaker.
I know. Isn't that a great title?
And he should have, and he regretted changing it, which I know he's talked about. But like,
I think Sorcerer is kind of it fits the mood of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole point he talks about how I think he felt it was like an homage to The Exorcist, which didn't really work. I mean, it doesn't make sense with the movie. I mean,
No. I have a friend who forgets what it is every time. I'm like, you want to watch Sorcerer? Which one is that? Trucks.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Right. Right.
Like, why don't they call it Trucks?
I mean, look, it's a great title. I think that's the funny thing. Like honestly, The Wages of Fear is one of the great titles.
Like maybe the fifth greatest
any
movie title ever,
piece of fiction. I mean, it's like a perfect title. Totally. So, I mean, I think, certainly.
You're not going to top that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorcerer elicits that type of a realm of mythic table setting. It's just like not
well, and there's an interesting because in the, you know, in Sorcerer, right, it's the name of one of the trucks, right?
Yeah.
And I think there is an interesting distinction there between, you know, in Wages they are given the trucks by the company, right, which has its own, there's some beautiful poetry to that, right? But in Sorcerer they like refurbish and build the trucks themselves, basically. They're like, so they're like engineering, right, their own, what they think might be their salvation, but is their own, is their destruction,
is their
right?
Yeah.
Which has, you know, I think its own thing going on there. But yeah, I also love that, like, you know, he pivots it kind of to the jungle, right? And he just that thing of like, and he did freaking write Sorcerer?
I don't know.
Who wrote Sorcerer?
I don't know. It was, I'm seeing here, it was Waylon Greene.
Well, okay, Waylon. I just think it's interesting that like you're going.
Yeah, Waylon Greene wrote The Wild Bunch. He wrote.
Sure, okay.
Oh, you know what he wrote, Jen? Have you ever seen this movie? He wrote The Border. Did you ever see The Border with Jack
Nicholson? Oh, yeah. The Jack Nicholson movie. Yeah.
Yeah, we did that once in our pandemic movie club. Yeah.
That was Nicholson and Keitel, right?
Keitel, yep. Tony Richardson. It was, you know, the famous British filmmaker. It was his movie. That's kind of an interesting movie. That kind of gets forgotten. Warren Oates is in it, Valerie Perrine. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, same writer.
Gotcha. That tracks though. That all feels.
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah.
You know, on the edge of the world, yeah. Desperation. Yeah.
I just kind of love that he.
Dudes
rock movie.
Dudes rock.
Sorcerer is kind of, I mean, they're both kind of dudes rock movies.
Well, they're kind of like dudes don't rock. Well, like,
dudes might rock.
Dudes try to rock.
I mean, I always think that's also partly, you know, like, a little ironic sometimes.
Right. Like you're saying, the dude's rock thing is, in fact, true. The
filmography of Michael Mann is built on dudes rock, but sometimes those dudes don't rock.
No, man.
Right.
Like, not all the dudes in Heat rock, guys.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
That's funny.
But no, it is, it's this thing of, I love that, like, when transposing the movie, they're like, we're going to take this one sequence that involves this sort of like wooden lift, sort of half bridge lift thing. We're just going to make it a full like rope bridge in the jungle and it's going to be storming, right? I think the bridge sequence in Sorcerer is like maybe one of the greatest suspense sequences I've ever seen in a movie. And then they get to, okay, but what about the scene where they find the boulder? Fuck it. It's a tree. It's just a big tree. We're going to make it a big tree. It won't be a problem. Like, I just kind of love that there's this like willingness to almost, which I feel like can be hard for a lot of remakes, but this willingness to be like, well, it's not broken. Right. So like, we're just going to do the thing. And how much of like a one-to-one, comparison a lot of the movie makes. But speaking of that, I suppose I could use this as a segue, but like rewatching something like Yojimbo was very funny to me because we just recently did a Clint Eastwood episode on the B-side.
Oh, okay.
And so I Fistful of Dollars was fresh in my mind from a rewatch. And that's another kind of funny one in terms of I had not seen Yojimbo in, I don't know, maybe 15 years.
Same.
And
it's been a while. It was
fun to rewatch because there's such a especially with that and its remake, Sergio Leone, you can feel him kind of there's a lot more, and it feels weird to say about one of his spaghetti westerns, but there's like a lot more morality to it. Than there is in Yojimbo, right?
I agree.
Specifically as it pertains to like the two warring factions, right? Like in, you know, Leone crafts like a specific antagonist in the movie for Clint Eastwood to kind of go up against, which is in its own way a smart thing to do. And it's very effective in that movie. But I forgot that Yojimbo is literally just like everybody's bad. Like there's just which creates its own kind of, I think, wonderful atmosphere in the movie where like in say Fistful of Dollars, when he shoots three of the dudes in the beginning and they're quote unquote sort of like working for we won't call them the good guys, but like the better of the two groups, you know, you're a little bit like, oh, well, why is he killing those guys? Where in Yojimbo, when he makes sashimi out of the dudes, you're just kind of like, yeah, okay, yeah, they're all bad. They're all bad. Go for it. Like, which is kind of fascinating, but it was fun to watch that and then immediately watch Sanjuro. Cause I had not seen Sanjuro since like college. And that was just, I kind of forgot what a different beast that movie is.
It really is. It's a lot more sitting around and talking.
But it's like the sneaky sauce to both movies is that they're both very funny, right? Like, so even the sitting around, like the structure of Sanjuro is basically like literally an In Media Res thing, right? Because our hero is like waking up from a nap, like while a movie's happening. And he's kind of overhearing these samurai talking about maybe betraying their master because their master might be corrupt, but he overhears it and he stops them and there's a lot more going on. But what I love is that the successive nature of that movie is basically, it's basically Toshirô Mifune and the Sanjuro character basically almost not wanting to engage in a Yojimbo sequel, right? Like this thing of him kind of being like, no, I'm just taking a nap. And like, if you have some money or if you have some money or some food, I'll take either one of those and I'll be on my way. And then like each time he's like, wait, no, you guys are idiots. I got to do this. Okay. Yeah. And it's like this back and forth of like them trying a thing, them screwing it up and him just kind of shrugging and just being like, all right, well, I'll do it myself. And it is, I kind of wasn't expecting that format and I found it deeply entertaining.
Yeah.
He keeps getting pulled in. Like once he thought he was out and they pull him back in. Yep.
But not in a like melodramatic way.
No.
He's exasperated the whole
time.
Well,
it's interesting too, because, you know, obviously Yojimbo is the more famous of the two. It really did. It was a phenomenon, you know, in Japan when it came out. It kind of rewrote the samurai narrative. You know, obviously it comes post World War II, where Japan is in obviously a very intense period of transition. And I was listening to the commentaries on both Criterion discs, and it was interesting because I believe the guy for both is his name Stephen Price, who was the gentleman? Let me make sure. But anyway, these movies, specifically Yojimbo, take place during the Tokugawa period in Japan, where like modernization was happening. So like you have that in Yojimbo where you have this Ronin who basically is like, you know what? I don't have a master anymore. I don't have a home. I have all these skills and I'm going to make some money, right? Yeah. Which like obviously goes against everything that the Code of Bushido like says, which is referenced in the movie. And so Kurosawa got criticism for it being a blockbuster, right? Like Yojimbo is like his fun, violent movie, right? Like he had you know, it was like his blockbuster, you know what I mean? But even within it is there's so much commentary, right? And so I think it's one of those funny things. It becomes huge. The character becomes huge, right? And so he's going to adapt a book. And Toho is like, look, you got to make another one of these freaking Sanjuro movies. Because with the people. And so it's a funny thing. It's kind of like Rambo 2 to Rambo a little, where like Sanjuro's more likable in the second one, right? Like Rambo 1, First Blood, was called First Blood, it wasn't called Rambo, right? First Blood is, you know, a Sly Stallone, it's PTSD, it's people won't leave me alone, you know, you don't know what I've done for this country, Vietnam vet, da 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 da. And then Rambo 2, it's like, you know, are we allowed to win again? Can we win this time? It's like very pro, you know, what if we won the war? You know, we are still exceptional. And it's not like Sanjuro's that. At all, really, but it is the thing of like, he is noble, you know, like Yojimbo, he kind of is, but really he goes in, he's like, I'm just, I'm going to burn this town down. And
what I kind of like about Sanjuro though is it's not, and it's again, it's a pretty breezy movie.
Yeah. And Sanjuro is also, it is funnier.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, but what I like about it is the humor kind of, it sort of eases the like heaviness of what kind of runs through it, which is that I guess we'll call him a governor.
The Chamberlain, yeah.
Yeah. Who basically gets kidnapped. Right.
Yeah.
And they rescue his wife, and his wife is kind of along for the ride while they're trying to figure out where he was taken. And that's sort of the basic ongoing conflict of the movie. But there's this running thing of like her, telling Sanjuro like, oh, you kill a lot of people.
And he's like, killed too many people.
And he kind of is like, oh yeah, I guess, I guess I do. Like, it's
I
this
think
interesting...
I killed too many people. So that's a good point. I haven't thought about that.
It is this kind of like, it doesn't, to be clear, it doesn't stop him really from like killing more people necessarily, but it is an interesting thing that like the movie is also clearly reckoning with in the face of Yojimbo, yeah. Right? Is like, well, you know, and I think it does dovetail nicely with this, with a movie about a guy who doesn't want to be in a Yojimbo movie, right? Which is also meta, because like, to your point, Dan, you know, I mean, I'm sure Mifune got paid handsomely, but it's this thing of like,
well, I think he had fun making the movie.
Sure.
Once he was making it, you know, I think High and Low comes next, you know, right. So if you,
which is my favorite,
my favorite
that
movie as well.
Is so good.
Ugh. Yeah. I mean, you know, on any given day, you know, maybe the best movie ever made, right? High and Low is truly an incredible film. So, I mean, in this run, by the way, Hidden Fortress, The Bad Sleep Well, Yojimbo, Sanjiro, High and Low, Redbeard. It's like,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
So ridiculous. It's just such a ridiculous. And like, I'm even skipping, I'm sure smarter people than I would point to movies, you know, behind and before that are equal, you know, or better, you know, but I think it's just such an incredible run. So Sanjiro is kind of the fun one, you know what I mean? Which I think is a funny, it's definitely the lightest of them, you know, even to the point where like we're talking about, you know, if it's not a sequel to Yojimbo, is it even regarded in the same way? Right, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think, what do you, Jen, how do you feel about them together? Or, you know,
I think Yojimbo is the better movie, but they're very different. They almost feel more like companion pieces. Like, I don't want to say like it's a hangout picture, but like compared to that.
Kinda, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit. But what's interesting too is I hadn't seen Yojimbo in a long time, and I know that Kurosawa would say that, you know, he got the idea from like The Glass Key, but it's more like Red Harvest, and I'm a huge Miller's Crossing person. And so I kind of had that in the back of my mind when I was watching this and thinking, yeah, everybody is bad, just like in Miller's Crossing. Like, they're all corrupt. Yes. And so it was just kind of interesting to see that. Like, he's cynical, and it's a different beast than, you know, Fistful of Dollars, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and he has, you know, this is maybe half apocryphal, maybe it's not, but like the famous, obviously when the Leone movies came out and there was the thing of like, is anyone going to pay?
Yeah, exactly.
Could Kurosawa
sue?
And then somebody asked Kurosawa, I think this is a quote, or it might be half apocryphal. Somebody was like, what do you think about these movies? You know, and he was like, well, I remade Red Harvest, you know, imply nobody paid Dashiell Hammett, you know, so.
Exactly.
And it's funny because The Glass Key always comes up, but really you're right. Miller's Crossing is really kind of an adaptation of The Glass Key. And, you know, they're similar, but Red Harvest, Yojimbo and Fistful, those are directly, are all very similar. The difference is like, motivation, right? The thing about I don't know if you guys have read Red Harvest, but like the Continental Op, right? He's like tasked to go into the town to resolve.
It's like more deliberate.
So like you know, in the first page of that book, it's like, hey, they sent me in. I got to deal with this town. Whereas like in Yojimbo, one of the most beautiful things in that movie is the opening, right? Cause it's like, speaking of wages and these movies and this idea of just kind of existential kind of, you know, where's the wind blowing and you don't know what your tomorrow's going to bring. You know, he literally comes to a crossing at a road and picks at random which way to go. And then once he sees the dog with, you know, carrying the hand, which is, you know, what,
brilliant.
One of the 15 most iconic images in cinema history, probably. Like he, and it was funny, the commentary or one of the docs on the Criterion, they talk about Kurosawa himself got the idea because a grip was working on something and dropped his gloves on the ground, and Kurosawa like looked and saw the gloves and briefly thought they were hands, and he was like, ugh! And he like got the idea.
Which
I think is just an interesting kind of what a creative person. And, but so then like, you know, when Sanjiro goes into the town, he sees the dog, he looks at the town, he like sees the opportunity. So it's like he goes to the movie and then Sanjiro, the movie comes to him. And then, you know, the obvious also very interesting thing about both movies, but specifically Yojimbo, is like, you know, Mifune's a movie director. He's literally sitting on a chair in like three separate scenes watching his chaos unfold. Yeah. And so it's very, you know, at this point, Kurosawa was a master, you know, like he was beloved, right? Like, you know, in his time, you know, which is so rare for artists, obviously. So like, he's having, you know, it's very clear he's having fun with that. And, you know, it's a fun, it's like a very dark, fun movie. Sanjiro is very, is way lighter. I like
Yojimbo is like a mean, kind of a
it
mean.
It really
movie.
Is. Yeah.
And critical. I think critical.
Yep.
You know, critical of where Japan was. I mean, you know, like, you know, it's the flip side of, you know, Ozu a little, right? Where like, you know, there's a soft-handedness to Ozu's observation of post-World War II trauma, right? Yeah. It's very much like, how are we going to just get through what has happened, which we will never fully recover from, right? And then I think on the other side, Yojimbo's like, fuck that, dude. I'm trying to make, like, you know, and I don't know Kurosawa likes that that's the vibe. I just think he's rendering onto his viewers, you know, because I think, you know, that Japan became modern quickly, right? MacArthur went in there and was like, so here's how, you know, and it was like, you know, for better or worse. And a lot of people would say, obviously, you know, not for better. And so I think it's an interesting, I just find it funny he got criticized for making like a blockbuster. I just think that had me fascinated when I was like listening to the commentary, reading about it.
But did it become a MacGyver episode, though? I mean, isn't that how
it's
we
a good
know?
Question. You know what?
I don't think
you know,
honestly,
how many Yojimbos has there been, though? It must be so
maybe.
Many, right?
Yeah.
There must be something. There must be a version of Red Harvest that is an episode of television, right?
Would,
like,
yeah.
That feels...
Yeah.
Like, you're telling me
okay,
there's
so
not
like,
a...
Okay, so, like, I'm looking... This is just a...
There's not a minute. Rockford Files that's not Red Harvest or something, you know? Like.
So you have... So they say that the Corbucci movie Django is, like, a soft...
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I can see that. Uh-huh.
I'm seeing here Star Wars was based on The Hidden Fortress.
No.
Have you guys heard about this?
Oh, yeah. Star Wars from The Hidden Fortress.
Yeah. I love... I will tell you what. Can I just say this?
And a little bit the cantina scene I heard was a little bit of Yojimbo. Yeah.
That's interesting. But here's what I'll say. I had always, you know, when you grow up and you get into films, you hear about that, right? The Hidden Fortress Star Wars thing.
Sure.
I caught up with The Hidden Fortress late. I will tell you, I was shocked. How much it Star Wars owed. Where you are, I mean, when you watch
was
Hidden
it,
Fortress, you are like,
it,
oh.
I think the quote you're thinking of, was that someone asking Kurosawa about Star Wars?
I thought it was about.
No, you might, maybe you're right.
Leone. I mean,
it could be about either, honestly.
But anyway, so like, so just to kind of put a pin in it. So Last Man Standing, the Walter Hill movie, is a pretty direct.
Yeah.
Yojimbo, you know, almost the most, probably the most direct, actually, remake.
To Red Harvest, you mean?
Like, no, I was re-looking at it. It really is
Yojimbo.
Yojimbo. Like, yeah, and I think he credits, you know, I think it's credited. Yeah, he credits Yojimbo in that movie.
Yeah.
And then obviously Plenty of Seven Samurai. And then, yeah, it's funny, there isn't. And then obviously, I'm looking at all these, you know, Akira, obviously that the Bill Nighy movie Living was obviously a direct credit to Akira. It's just funny. It's like.
Have either of you seen the Bad Sleep Well?
I have, but again, I haven't seen that probably since college. Yeah.
I watched that a few years ago when we did our Toshirô Mifune up for the first time. That movie is great. It's like, it's corporate espionage. And, that movie, I mean,
the one that people sleep on a little that I caught in the theater actually last year is Dreams.
Love Dreams.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I love Dreams too.
I think that was the first one I ever saw. Yeah.
That's really? Funny. That's interesting. Cool. That was like one of his last films. Rhapsody in August comes next and there's one more film, but
I
Dreams.
Saw that as a kid. Yeah.
That's interesting. Dreams. It's, you know how people, you know how a criticism of Inception was that the dreams are not like creative enough, right? Remember, it was that thing of
like
Nolan has this architectural mind and he doesn't have this sense of like, and I always thought that was kind of an unfair criticism because it's like, how do you know what people dream? You know what I mean?
Right,
people
right.
dream dreams. It's like, if you know, I don't know. I don't want to speak for that being said, as much as I love Inception, the thing about Dreams is, and Jen, I'm sure you agree with, like, it really does capture the thing about dreams.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're watching it and you're like, another thing happens and you're like, oh yeah, in the world of the, and it's, you know, it is, I believe it was Kurosawa's dreams, right? That's what he was making his renderings. And you are like, it is like that. All of a sudden, you're in a forest and this weird thing happened and it just makes sense because that's the world you're in. And it's like, and I think it's one of those things he did really well of like, he never oversold, you know, as a filmmaker. Yeah. I think he was always really good at like showing, not telling. You know, I think, and I think
that's... And having, like, confidence in his audience, right? Like, as a part of that, right?
Like, yeah, and look, making films, you know, in a country like Japan allows for that more than a country like, you know, in terms of just kind of more support and all that. But totally, yeah, he just was so, the confidence, my God, it's like something like Ran, you know what I mean? Oh, my God. It's like what he's able to do at such a high level. And even Redbeard, which I don't... Redbeard, I don't love. Me and Connor were talking about. It's so, it's, you want to talk about people talking in rooms. My God. It's just like, the 3-hour movie where they're just like, just talk about like issues. Like, what's just ish? And you're like, I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm with you on that one. Yeah.
And like Mifune hated that movie. That movie was part of their split. He was like, Mifune was like, what are you doing, dude? I'm going to leave. I'm doing other stuff. This is crazy. Like,
can I get in one fight, please? He's like, yeah. I can.
He's like, you used to make fun movies, dude. Yeah. What are you, a doctor in a village town? What are you doing, man? But anyway, yeah, it's fun.
This is great. Yeah. So do you guys have the new editions from Criterion?
This was nice because I only owned Yojimbo and Sanjuro on the regular Blu-ray, and I meant to upgrade, and I did not own Wages of Fear, so this gave me an excuse to get both of them,
which was very nice.
They all, if for anyone listening who's a physical media enthusiast, they all look great in 4K. So, I feel like sometimes with older movies, I think people might be skeptical with like, oh, do I really need to like upgrade this?
Yeah.
And I get that way sometimes too, depending on what the movie is, but it is all three of these movies. Their transfers are so great and the contrast is so wonderful that just like specifically for like, you know, I mean, Wages of Fear, which is maybe one of the best looking black and white movies ever made, you know, it just looks really incredible, so I would for sure recommend it.
Let me actually, just so I don't forget, the gentleman on the Criterion that I, Connor, you were, gifted me.
Because I upgraded.
Because you upgraded.
I gave mine away to a coworker. So there you go.
See, you're good. Yeah. These are good people. Stephen Prince is the author. He wrote The Warrior's Camera. He does the commentary for those older editions that I listen to. And I thought, you know, like I said, I am not an expert. You know, I've watched what I've watched. I love, you know, I love the films. But I was fascinated. I love the commentary. I watched the films and then I rewatched them with the commentary and I was very like, it was lovely. Like, I think he really contextualizes the scene, speaks to the comedy. Yeah. I don't know if there must be new stuff in the new editions, I'd imagine. You know, like new essays and whatever, but
I haven't really gone over the compare and contrast of that. I was just mainly in it for the
look.
The
transfer.
So far anyway, but yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, no, I think.
No.
And we're getting a Sorcerer
next month.
Is that true? Who's that? Is that Criterion?
Criterion, yeah.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
There you go. That. Yeah. Sounds good. And you know what? Maybe as a bonus, they're going to throw that MacGyver in there.
I'm going to watch that. I think
it said season 1, episode 8. I'm like, I got to go look that up right now. Yeah.
But, it must be on like Daily Motion or something. So
yeah. MacGyver's got to be streaming. So Hellfire. You're telling me MacGyver's not on Pluto TV just hanging out or something? Come on.
Must be, right?
Absolutely. Well, Connor and Dan, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's always such a pleasure. You'll have to come back for another topic.
Of course. Our pleasure. This was great. Thanks for having us back.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.